Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Joining me from places far and away is Grant Newsham. Grant, how are you today? Sorry I'm late.
Fine, thanks.
I was waxing eloquent, just so you know. You could be assured of that. I want to ask you, you're a writer, so you're a journalist, even though you may not care to embrace that, but that part of your life, but you are nonetheless. It's been very interesting to me, and another incident occurred over the weekend relative to the dissent of the New York Times devolved into a poorly managed high school newspaper. And I mean, you're a journalist and just from my experience with you, you enjoy intellectual discourse. Right. And people that do tend not to limit themselves except to, avoiding the absurd. But we'll entertain that even at times, depending on their mood. When you see things like historians absolutely ripping the 1619, project apart, and the New York Times surreptitiously editing, its prominent claims out with no footnotes. And then you see, like this past week, one of its columnists, got after the 1619 Project and said it was a failure. And the union said, that person should be disciplined, fired, and weeded out, blah, 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 blah. What do you think about all of that? To me, it's stunning stuff for supposedly the nation's paper of record.
As for intellectual discourse, I much prefer the accomplished yes man, but I just can't find enough of them. The media, the news reporting profession, is they're committing suicide. They've committed it, I think, and. One thing that when you're say our age, we remember when there was such a thing as, remember when there was an expression, foreign correspondent.
Yes.
And that was some guy, sometimes women as well, who went overseas and where it was rough, in places nobody else could or would go, and explained what was happening. And as I said, explained what was happening. They didn't explain what they think should be happening or what they thought of it. Except in rare circumstances, but they would present the facts and let the reader make up their mind. And that pretty much, go back and read newspapers, you probably have to go back 30, 40 years, actually, and read a story, and you would generally have no idea who the author wrote, who the writer voted for. And that is long since gone. There are exceptions, but it's older reporters who are sort of hanging on some newspapers. It's funny to say older reporters, but that's right. I guess what they would you'd call them if they were 20. And you see what's happened at the New York Times, and it is an instructive example of the insanity. This is Chinese cultural revolution nuttiness, Soviet Union sort of dishonesty, straight out of George Orwell, where these younger people working in media have taken over the newsrooms. And, they do the equivalent of holding their breath and stamping their feet until they get their way. Right. But even worse, they actually go on the offensive. And as you've seen, they call for people who say the wrong thing, which means they don't like it. It is not part of their approved view of how the world is or should be or how society, American society needs to transform. And they do everything they can to crucify these people, only a little bit less than literally. And you see seen this at the New York Times. The Washington Post has the same problem, all brought on by themselves and by its management. And the The other one is the Wall Street Journal, which considered one of the last bastions of sanity in the reporting business. They've got some problems at the report, that younger reporter level as well, you know, raising their voices about them putting out stories and the management not being woke or, you know, attuned to social justice enough. And that's scary to see that. So, but also this, you know, it's not like these people just came out of the blue. You know, they're the product of journalism schools or whatever it is that passes for indoctrination these days, as opposed to like actually learning how to read and write. And it is about that bad. You know, if you said, you know, we'll give you $1 million for every like really good reporter you can think of who is allowed to publish their stuff. And I would have a few $1 million, but I wouldn't be fabulously wealthy, even if I sat here all morning or all night trying to think about it. And the, you know, so it is about that bad. There are good ones, but they, you know, it's maybe like in after the barbarians came through Europe a few times, you'd get these hermits living up in caves who kind of kept these standards alive, for civilization alive for a while. You know, whether they're going to be entirely snuffed out, I don't know. But it is that bad. It's if you're old enough to remember when it used to be that the reporting class, the media had some respect for the readers, that it's depressing. Those days are they're pretty long gone, to my way of thinking. And the idea that somehow, well, that this is just to get rid of Mr. Trump, and then we'll go back to normal. Well, that never happens.
Do you believe that? I mean, the transformation is, we used to have reporters. Now we have activists masquerading as reporters with their agenda at the top of the masthead. And if anybody thinks that if Joe Biden's elected, that this agenda, coupled with the enforcement arm, which is the council, which is the cancel culture, right, is going back inside its banks, you're crazy. You're crazy. And when you see, I don't know if you saw, did you see Barry Weiss's resignation letter to the New York Times when she resigned?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I mean, to think that somebody would describe the New York Times in the terms of new McCarthyism I'll read from it. Or perhaps it's because they know that nowadays standing up for principle at the paper does not win plaudits. It puts a target on your back. Too wise to post on Slack. Do you know what is Slack? Is it kind of an internal New York Times thing?
Oh, I don't know.
It says, too wise to post on Slack. They write to me privately about the new McCarthyism that has taken root at the paper of record. I mean, that the new McCarthyism? I mean, are you kidding me? I don't know, Grant. It's just to me, there's like, we can have a guy like Donald Trump. But if the institutions are what the institutions have always been, then whatever your take on Donald Trump is, we will ultimately survive that. The nation will survive that, okay? It survived George Bush, the younger, okay? But when the institutions themselves that are supposed to be reporters, right, are supposed to report the first, as she says earlier in the article, they're supposed to report the first, you know, the first account of the truth comes from a reporter. This is what happened. When they're no longer faithful to that, when they self-describe themselves as, well, not essentially a reporter, but a correspondent, what does that mean? Does that mean your opinions bleed into what you write and you're not a reporter reporting what you see? Well, sometimes I'm called on to give opinions, and in that case, I do that, and a reporter would not, so I am a hybrid. Okay, right? Where does it go from there? Is it a hybrid with a political agenda? And so, I don't know. I mean, to me, when you get into this, and then, you know, then one of their writers, the way this got on my radar again, was one of their writers over the weekend took to the op-ed pages of the Times and took the 1619 Project to task. Now, with a sense of relief, it was like, oh my God, at least they published something that was critical of the thing, when historians, not conservatives, but academic historians are calling for the returning or the rescinding of the Pulitzer Prize that it was awarded. Right. And so, well, at least somebody opened up the window at the New York Times. And so the union, the New York Times Guild, then tweeted out that that person should be fired, because they weren't in lockstep with the party line. And you read this shit and you're just like, good God, man, how does that guy, Sulzberger, who, in my opinion, is just he's as weak as the mayor of Minneapolis. How does he look himself in the mirror and go to work every day? What he's done with the New York Times, it's amazing. I don't know. It's just, to me is what causes me pain, is when the institutions stray from their historical roles and won't do that anymore, and they're bent on activism. It's like, this is not going to end well.
No, and you know that the guys who pinned women, who let it happen, you know, as this sort of subversion took place, I think they all knew what was happening, and they each thought, well, a little bit doesn't matter, I can control it just for a little while. There's all sorts of excuses to not do something about it, and now I do wonder if it's too late, but at least in the, you know, in a historical sense, probably not, because you get... You know, things come and go, and you get completely insane. There's all sorts of destruction, and then people come back to normal. But I would prefer not to go through that process. But it's, you know, it's, I don't know what to say. You know, there was I've known, when I talked about that expression, foreign correspondent. You know, I've known a few of these over the years, and you had guys like Richard Halloran, who just passed away, who was with New York Times out in Asia for many years, John Rich with NBC News, who was on the fourth wave at Iwo Jima, Richard Harwood at the Post. There's these older guys that were reporters, and it's, you'd be like, I don't know, finding a smart Texan, or no, I'm joking, I couldn't resist, but like a unicorn, you know, it's really something. And the good ones, there are some. In fact, there's probably more than I would think. But they're, you know, you get the impression they keep their heads low and they, you know, try to get their shots in and then duck back for cover. So it is about as bad as you think. And I first noticed this probably at least 30 years ago. But as that World War II Korea generation died, sort of went west, it was these. A bunch of people who'd done a semester abroad in Paris, had an MA from somewhere, but knew nothing about the world, etc., thought that we all should care what they think, as opposed to learning how to actually be good reporters and get information, and information nobody else could get, and present it to the reader. And that actually can actually sell papers, but I don't really care so much what... someone who did a semester abroad at Paris has to say about world or life. So that's it. But, you know, I must sound crotchety, but I don't, you know, I'm not sure too many other people do. And maybe that's why not so many people are subscribed to newspapers these days and get their news somewhere else. But when you talk about that New York Times, the Guild, you know, you could make this, you know, Chinese Communist Party, Cultural Revolution, you know, group number 708, you know, turning on the local school principal and, you know, hounding him into suicide. You know, this is, it's, will we recover? I don't know. You know, we will see. But it is, you have to be very careful where you pick your news today.
Well, absolutely. And Barry Weiss, in her resignation letter, she says, let's see, for these young writers and editors, there is one consolation. As places like the Times and other once great journalistic institutions betray their standards and lose sight of their principles, Americans still hunger for news that is accurate, opinions that are vital, and debate that is sincere. I hear from these people every day. Quote, an independent press is not a liberal ideal or a progressive ideal or a democratic ideal. It's an American ideal. You said a few years ago, I couldn't agree more. America is a great country that deserves a great newspaper. And so again, amazing words. Now she's not a conservative. Okay. She's a liberal. She's a liberal describing this, which tells you how crazy it has to be. And so to me, her words give me hope that at some point somebody's going to create something that America's will flock to find quality reporting, interesting and diverse opinion that's articulate, and will support that commercially to make it viable.
Yeah, I think they will. You look at, even the Wall Street Journal is still surviving. You know, it's still got some standards, and people, you know, it's people buy it. People read it. Financial Times is another one. And just so I've been savaging a profession. There are good reporters who are not 112 years old, and if I don't mention a few of them, and somehow they hear about this show, that I'd be in trouble. But a couple of good ones are Claudia Rosette, who was with the Washington Post for many years. Wall Street Journal. Sorry. I delivered the Washington Post as a child, which is why I'm not 6 feet three of lugging the Sunday Post around. But she's writes was with the Wall Street Journal for a long time. Is excellent on Asia in particular, and she seems to appear a lot in the Dallas Morning News or so. But she's around, excellent.
Is she a reporter or a columnist or what?
I'd call her a reporter. She did she was back in Hong Kong during the protests because that was her stomping ground, and just wrote just excellent. It was so refreshing to read real reporting. There's Cheryl Atkinson of NBC News, who used to be with NBC News, obviously was driven out. Another good reporter. Francine Kiefer of the Christian Science Monitor is, still upholding that paper's standards, and I think they're slipping in a lot of other places. But these people would all be in their late 50s, 60s, I think. But that's still pretty young, I think. So there are a lot of good ones around. But at the same time, I think you would call them beleaguered is probably the correct word.
And that journalism is now a form of activism. And that's kind of the industry standard. And let me just tell you, I don't know where my life would be without the Wall Street Journal. I would tell you this. I think they do the best reporting. Their news reporting is, I think, absolutely solid. They still do solid news reporting. And I think and obviously I'm conservative, so I enjoy their opinion pieces. But to me, they're thoughtful opinion pieces. They're just not just bloviating nonsense. And so, and I know the Wall Street Journal is a bit pricey for most people. I would tell you, buy it. You know, it's well worth the money, and shut off the rest of that shit. I mean, because it is. It's just garbage. It's partisan garbage. And that's what characterizes most of the media today. And as Grant said, there's selective people. The Christian Science Monitor used to be famous for being right down the middle of the road. Right, Grant?
It was. It's slipping, but yeah, it was. That was what it was. It was known for. It was a smallish paper, but the name would open doors anywhere on earth. And there's still good people who write there. And Scott Tyson is another one who was reported from China for many years for them, and from the Iraq and Afghanistan business. But excellent reporters, the old school. Not the old, back when standards were such as they were.
Right. All right. I'll end this part of the, and then we'll kind of transition. But, hypothetically, if Joe Biden wins the election, does any of this change?
You would you'd have to ask, well, why would it? You know, if you're part of the braying mob and you're getting your way, you're moving forward, you're the enemies of the state and enemies of the people are cowering, why would you stop? If anything, it would be, let's take a victory lap and then redouble our efforts to create utopia, to get rid of these people who are thinking error. And I don't see it stopping. You never know. You know, sometimes we get a break, but the people who are doing this and think that what they are doing is right, not just think, they are convinced beyond any possible doubt. I can't think of a reason they would let up. And you'd reach a point where, you know, the people who control the purse strings, the publishers, the guys who finance these companies, you think, well, they at the end of the day, they can stop it. But no, sometimes the momentum builds up and the craziness is such that those people just get swept away or they just keep writing the checks because they're afraid they will lose everything if they don't pay out to the mob. So I'm at least as optimistic as you are.
These are prominent people that are resigning, and you see that, to include this tweet from the Times Guild, that this article reeks and this guy's just isn't playing by the rules and, you know, and blah, blah, blah. And then in Barry Weiss's is her resignation letter, she talks about the harassment she endured at the New York Times. And you're like, this is high school stuff. And that guy, tolerated it. And you're just thinking, holy shit, man. Holy shit. And so to me, more important than who occupies the White House, this is just McNamara speaking, is how the nation goes about, you know, intellectual discourse. And in my opinion, the greater casualty, depending on who occupies the White House, is that the discourse in the nation is dysfunctional and broken for most people. There is no more McNeil Lear NewsHour. Nobody, that does not exist on television anymore. And I don't know. I learned a long time ago in talk radio, if you want to make a lot of money, be shrill, be loud, and those are all the guys who make the most money. Do not be measured, balanced, articulate, and reasonable. You know, and expect to make a lot of money, because you won't. Which tells you a little bit about what the market calls for. So anyway, it's just another reason to be depressed. In case you did not have enough. All right, let's talk about. There's an article in the United States in the news today. Three more American arms agreements with Taiwan. You spent a lot of time in Taiwan. What's going there? And is Taiwan, this is on the heels of the United States admonishing, I don't know how you would characterize it, you can fill us in, Taiwan about, hey, your military budget's not what it should be. So can you give us the footnotes and the three arms sales, the admonition to the Taiwanese, and increased "quote unquote" military activity around the island of Taiwan?
The arms sales. I just read it very quickly, but it looks like the Trump administration has improved selling three particular weapon systems. One is the HIMARS that the Marines know.
Right.
And then the SLAM, it's like a very long range, I think, air launched missile.
Right.
And I forget what the third one was. But at least the two of these three are the kinds of things that you need for Taiwan's defense, which is the ability to shoot way, way far out and hit what you're aiming at and destroy it or crack the ship in half or whatever you do. And that's the things that will give, you know, that are useful in a defense. You know, and these weapons have been considered off limits for a long time. you know, it's been obvious that Taiwanese could use them, and they've quietly asked for them. But the on the American side, successive administrations have sort of cowered, thinking, oh, what will the Chinese think if we do this? It'll anger the Chinese. So the fact that they're selling these weapons that are going to be really, if you sell enough of them, employ them the right way, and then sell a lot, some other weapons too, and then Taiwan also develops their own stuff, that is the sort of thing that will give an attacker problems. And this is actually selling useful equipment. Just some context to give you a sense of how America, successive administrations, Republican and Democrat, tried to give Taiwan just enough oxygen to stay alive, but not strangle it, so it died.
Right.
The Taiwanese wanted SAMs, you know, these shoulder-fired missiles, like the Stingers. And like we would, you know, hand it out to the Afghans, you know, like, you know, popcorn. They'd want these things. And America would not let the Taiwanese have them. Instead, they sold them these fixed sort of SAM systems that were it'd be like taking a shoulder-fired one and putting like a 500-pound block of concrete on the base so you couldn't move it around. And that's how crazy it was. And you could talk for a long time about how we did mistreated Taiwan in this regard. And the thinking was, we don't want Taiwan to attack China or provoke China. We don't want China to be angry. We need their help with climate change, global warming, transnational crime, North Korea, et cetera, et cetera, none of which we ever got.
And the art of the weapons sale is to, we'll sell the Taiwanese something that we know the Chinese can defeat. And that way we won't anger the Chinese.
Oh, it was very much a too clever by half sort of thinking by the, I don't know them, entrenched, long-serving bureaucrats in DOD. And then that State Department can't be helped. That's kind of like a dog licking itself. It's what it does. And the military, U.S. military, didn't exactly protest about this as much as they should have. There were always, of course, people who, you know, we're sounding the alarm, but in general, that's how it worked. So the Chinese in the last month or two, even by normal standards, stepping up the pressure on Taiwan with sending a lot of aircraft closer than ever before to Taiwan, you know, to intimidate, threaten them. They've done a number of large exercises, including big amphibious exercises, all intended, of course, to scare Taiwan. And at the same time, you do exercises, you're building your capability. And, you know, so the idea that they're just posturing, they're bluffing, you know, how do you know? You know, a lot of people say this with such certainty, but I'm not aware of too many of them that have, like, sat in the room at Zhongnanhai in Beijing where Xi and his guys are thinking about this stuff. But everybody knows. Based on what? But you can't rule this out. The Chinese have got the capability to launch an assault now if they wanted to. You can argue that point, but I think they can. But they would prefer to get Taiwan without fighting, so scaring the hell out of everybody is the a better way to do it. They but also wait and see who gets elected as the next president. You may go back to this policy towards Taiwan of sort of smothering it and allowing it to just gradually go quietly.
Well, I mean, come on, that's right. That's the boa constrictor model, right? And to me, I don't think. You know, I mean, a war against the United States or the West. I mean, I think China's already, if you look at it, I think from their perspective, I always find it constructive to turn the map. Okay, let's be them. We're sitting here. What are we concerned about? Well, we were making really good inroads, and now we've gotten sideways with the United States, and now Europe is starting, now, and then the COVID thing, and now Europe is starting to kind of beat the drum a little bit. That does not bode well for us. And, you know, the Huawei issue is a big deal. I mean, obviously we have not succeeded in pulling the wool over their eyes completely, because they're now pushing back across the world, at least in the Western democratic nations, whose GDP we could sorely use to investing in our technology. So to me, any further hostilities are ratcheting up, our posturing doesn't serve us as a nation. You know, we need to build up our military in a benign way, and that way we don't alienate their economic activity within our country, and then in that way it enables the boa constrictor. Does that make sense? I mean, so to me, the confrontation thing, we can dance around and nothing serious, and we'll let the Taiwanese know, and hopefully that will fan the flames inside of Taiwan, and they will come to us willingly, and we believe that will happen over time, and yada, yada, yada. So to me, I don't see a conflict with the Chinese, as maybe I'm, I could be totally wrong, but I just don't see it in either Chinese interest or American interest.
Well, no. I think my sense is that the Chinese are serious when they say they won't wait forever and they will use force if necessary. I would take them seriously on this. That's my sense of it. Just as I was pretty sure that Washington football team is going to the Super Bowl. But that said, I'm pretty solid in my thinking on that. In terms of their capability to do it, I think they can. But would they rather get it easily? Of course they would. Particularly when you consider the knock-on effects of shooting at Taiwan and occupying the place. Then you're basically all your trade with the rest of the world is going to stop overnight. And finally, we might actually cut off the flow of dollars to China. That would really hurt them. But if you think about it, if they were to get Taiwan, you've broken the so-called first island chain. It's easy, smooth sailing out into the Pacific from there. But also the political effects of that, you would find South Korea go into China's arms in about 30 seconds afterwards. Japan would be absolutely just flummoxed. They wouldn't know what to do. And would probably end up cutting a deal of some sort with China. The rest of Southeast Asia would all go towards China, and the U.S. would really have no foothold in Asia anymore. We would be humiliated. Nobody would take us seriously. A promise we make would be nothing. And that's Taiwan, or have it go under. And literally, the Asia would turn red. That's how I see the knock-on effects. But so for Taiwan's China's perspective, if you get all that just for taking Taiwan, maybe worth a shot. So it's one way to look at it. And what the Americans have been doing, and this is, it's funny to see, because you get these, they call them teams of Americans, sometimes government officials, sometimes ex-government officials looking for a job in a new administration, academics, and even particularly that's most, and what it is mostly, those kind. And they cycle through Taiwan, Taipei, and they meet with Taiwanese officials and think tanks, and scream at them, you got to spend more on defense, you have to spend more on defense, and you have to have an asymmetric defense, blah, blah, blah. And the Taiwanese are very polite, listening to this, feeling like they have to. But that those people come in and they chant the mantra. And without, as if they've done their duty, they've read the riot act to the Taiwanese, but they really don't offer anything specific of how America and Taiwan are going to get a closer alliance, going to get a, particularly on the defense front. And to me, the truth teller is that after all these years, we still will not do joint exercises with the Taiwan military. So the Taiwan military has been in isolation for 40 years. And if you went to like a Taiwan Marine base, for example, you would feel like you were at Camp Lejeune in about 1978. If you're isolated like that, you just don't progress. It's depressing psychologically. And your defense capability, of course, shrinks. It withers. And so, but nobody, no administration yet, and unfortunately, not even this one, even though some of the people know better and would have done better, we still won't get out and about with the Taiwan military. You know, and I've been doing the broken record thing of, you know, get their amphibious force out to Guam with ours and do joint training, joint HADR training, just something to break them out of the isolation. There is one exception that did take place in 2017 that got no attention, and a Taiwan Marine platoon went to Kaneohe Bay and did training with the U.S. Marines, and that was really something, but it hasn't been followed up on. And it really, on the U.S. side, it's been us not wanting to provoke China, and too many officials and even military guys who get into these government jobs temporarily, they think they know best what Taiwan ought to be buying and making and doing. You know, you hear this expression, well, they want to build amphibious ships, and that'll, and then they, somebody throws out the word opportunity costs as if they know what it means. But it's the hot term that gets tossed around in D.C. when it comes to Taiwan not doing what we think they should. So we'll see where this plays out. There's lots of opportunity to improve it. But this administration has been better than most. It might have done a few things differently, but we'll see. This is an issue. Taiwan is an issue that is, I think, going to be at the forefront of events in Asia for whoever is the next administration and onwards. And I don't think it's going to sort of just muddle along indefinitely. I think this is going to be in the news a lot, and we'll see how we handle it.
You wrote a piece a few days ago, the United States and South Korea, best friends forever, ? Some troubling revelations and analysis. You're the first person really I've seen articulate this kind of stuff, Grant. First of all, talk about the article. I mean, we talked a couple weeks ago or maybe even before that about your observations relative to the fact that there might have been, to be blunt, South Korea's last election was hacked. And if you just do a news search on that, you'll see a fair amount of reporting by a lot of credible sources that speculate on that. South Korea, not friends with the United States? That sounds absurd to me.
Well, that's what most people's initial reaction is. It would almost be like thinking, well, us and the British, you know, not friends. You know, how could that possibly be? We share a long, tight history, and et cetera. But when you this has been really apparent for a long time that a big chunk of Korean society is, you know, what you would call leftist, but that's not so much the problem. It's more that within that are some people who are like really, you call them hardcore revolutionaries, anti-American, pro-China, pro-communist, pro-North Korea, and they've come out of that student movement of the whenever it was the 70s, 80s in South Korea, and they are now in positions of power. You know, and they've been periodically when they've had sort of left-leaning or leftist administrations in Korea after their elections, these people have all gotten in, moved up, and you've gotten even more of them. But they're in positions to dominate the key levers of power in South Korea. And so it would be the equivalent of, remember these people that President Obama, when he was in Chicago, he used to hang out with these just extreme sort of racist, fascist, I don't know what you'd call them, just really the kind of scary.
We don't really like to talk about that, Grant. I mean,
or but you know, but he hung out with these 60s radicals. How's that for a nice word? Or
there you say, go. There you go. There you go.
Take a professor from UC Santa Cruz.
Yeah, now, a tenured professor in the University of California system, but at in the 60s, a member of the Weathermen Underground.
You know, make one of them like a president or head of the intelligence service, head of the election commission. You get these and then get sort of a lot of them into the Congress. And you get these kind of extremists who do not represent a majority of thinking in Korea and probably not even in that party, but you get a hardcore committed revolutionaries bent on changing a society, and they can often shift a country in ways you would gradually in ways you would never imagine. And that's what I think, you know, we're seeing in South Korea. It's not a done deal yet, but it's that the role of these the people who emerged out of that anti-American, pro-North Korea, pro-communist, or pro-China sort of student movement from several decades ago, now in positions of power. And there's still many Koreans who, probably vast majority, who disagree with that, but the people often don't notice. And it's hard for outsiders who know, you know, we all know Korea, we've been there, Koreans, we've been there, we like them, and the ones we know are always pro and very pro-American. And so it's hard to imagine a country potentially shifting. And I cite an example of Turkey back in the 80s when, or excuse me, in early 2000s when Erdogan, the current president, prime minister, whatever he is, when he took over, that he was considered a sort of a religious extremist and sort of a fascist as well. But people, you know, U.S. government and elsewhere, they could all explain why there was nothing to worry about. And there's a list of reasons why not. And yet over time, Turkey, you know, has become kind of an enemy of ours. And not at all helpful. It's a headache in what we're trying to do in the region.
Grant, like
and
a lot
so Korea, Grant, something like that, it resembles Turkey. Okay.
Well, no. Like a lot of things, they are an enemy. We just won't call them that. The same thing with China. If it looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck and it walks like a duck, it's a parrot. Don't you know? Polly want a cracker? See, this is how we deal with Polly. No. It's a fucking duck. Oh, no. It's a parrot, Mac. Blah, 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 blah. The only reason we don't call, right, I don't know what the dance of the iguana is with Turkey, that we're so, that we haven't developed an alternative to the Incirlik base there. But I did notice that we based the USS or USNS ship Woody Williams, named after the Marine Medal of Honor recipient from Iwo Jima, in Greece. And I don't know if that wasn't a not-so-subtle warning to the Turks that, you know what, we have other friends in the region. We have other NATO allies. Maybe we'll just go there. But it's astounding to me, you know, that we play these pretend games. And I would submit to you, so what you're telling me, Grant, is people in Korea are woke now to the wonders and beauties of reunification with North Korea and the wonders and beauties of the Chinese, in the same way the United States has become woke to other issues as well.
Well, you've just got to have enough people who think that way and are ruthless enough and aggressive enough to create a revolution, to transform a society into never for anything good. I think there's empirical evidence of that, but yeah, that's what I think is the case. But once again, you'll hear the same excuses as to why there's nothing to worry about that you heard about Turkey as it transformed. And it took a good long while for the transformation to take place. And I think we should at least pay attention to this, but there seems to be a sort of a preference to just dismiss this as, oh, it can never happen. But think about it. You know, Venezuela, something similar happened. Iran, the Philippines. You know, the Philippines love us. You know, I've been to Subic and blah, blah, blah. You know, they had nothing. We'll never be kicked out of there. Well, we got kicked out. And the Zimbabwe, when Mugabe took over, you could hear any number of government people, academics, etc., explain, oh, he's really a Democrat. You know, Zimbabwe has an independent judiciary system, you know, free press, et cetera, et cetera. And you had people explaining this away. And any moderately alert moron knew exactly what Mugabe was going to do. But in the case of Korea, you know, I'm saying at least seriously consider this possibility and listen to what these people have said and ask yourself if they've changed. And, you know, we don't. You know, it's not authorized thought. It's like the newsroom at the New York Times. You know, people, you can't say it, or it's just too hard to imagine. That's what I was getting, just raising the possibility and trying to provide some evidence or make the case. That's what was behind this. But, you know, just because you've been friends for a long time doesn't mean you will be forever, sort of my take on it.
Got it. There's an article written in Bloomberg that I sent to you. The headline is China's insistence that Taiwan isn't a country starts backfiring. Thoughts on that? Did you get it? Did you have a chance to look at it?
To think that China is a friendly, the Chinese Communist Party that rules China is a friendly bunch. You'd really have to be on their payroll or else have done a semester abroad in Paris. The Chinese have bared their fangs and made it pretty clear what kind of regime they are. And, you know, they have, I think, made a serious mistake. Oh, goodness, probably, I don't know, 5-6 years ago when they, maybe longer, but they had been doing something called the Charm Offensive, where they were on their best behavior. All their diplomats around the world were, you know, smiling and saying how great friends, et cetera, et cetera. And they suddenly have just started talking about killing people and punishing people and, you know, making them pay for insulting all 1.4 billion Chinese people. And,
right.
You know, using the word Taiwan in public. And they, let's say, if they kept their charm offensive going, I'd say another 5 years, I think they'd have really been in a position of dominance in Asia and elsewhere in the world, too. But they've sort of shown who they really are, what kind of regime they are. And this has caused more people than ever, and particularly in those positions of power in governments and even in the academic world, there's some shifting of thought to actually now say that China is it's not our friend. You know, how do we get that wrong? A few of them will say that, but not many. And that is actually kind of helped Taiwan a bit because there's been more people who are saying or thinking, you know, why should we, sort of cringe in fear of the Chinese when it comes to Taiwan. You know, Taiwan is a sort of democratic, free nation full of Chinese people. Maybe we should be nicer to them. So this has gotten Taiwan a little better treatment in more quarters than has been the case in recent years. Whether or not it continues is always the issue. But the article does get it right that there's has been a change in how Taiwan is been treated, really in the last year or two, I think. It's a fairly recent thing.
The Reuters wrote a piece that I sent to you, Worsening Sino-U.S. I think it's Sino, right? Is it Sino or Sino? You know.
Well, if you had done a semester abroad in Paris, you would know it's Sino. No, it seems to be Sino, yeah. So, no, I couldn't resist.
Worsening Sino-U.S. Yeah. Ties huge risks to China's financial network. What's the risk? I mean, really, the goal of China is to usurp the rules-based post-World War II order right, that was largely the design of the United States, United Kingdom, right, and the monetary system that has existed post-World War II. So China's aim is to usurp that. Explain how worsening ties with the United States risks their financial network. And in particular, their absorption of Hong Kong. Will that have an impact on it?
The article actually focuses on China's inability to buy some of the equipment, the technology that they need for their efforts to get digital currency, to create almost a different infrastructure for buying and selling things, for moving money. There was that difficulty getting the technology they need for that financial transformation that they want to use to build up their own currency. It didn't really cover another part of the issue, which is if somehow America and America's Wall Street and American business were to stop pouring tens, maybe hundreds of billions of dollars into China every year, that would really cause them more trouble than not being able to buy the technology. So there's two aspects to it. The article was about trouble getting technology. Didn't address that I saw the American Quisling or the sort of traitor class funding the country that wants to destroy us. It didn't address that, but right, that's something that hopefully some administration will finally take on. One hopes.
I have a question, and I want to ask you about this story about the about Australia. China tensions reach skyscraper heights in Sydney. One of the things that you've made us smart about is how Australia is just further down the road in terms of Chinese, I won't say absorption, but Chinese influence operations in their country. And Australia's pushed back on it mildly and is paying a price for it. But before I ask you that, let's talk about that first, okay? Another Reuters headline. Do you find it interesting that Reuters seems to publish so much Chinese content?
Not so much, but because they actually still have reporters in the region, and a fair number of them, and actually I know a few of them that are excellent reporters. I should have mentioned those, and they're not that old either, but they have some good reporting. But Reuters, their headlines, if you read any story they write about China, it's always, the headlines are always written in a way that sort of placate the Chinese. You know, for example, if it's always America does such and such in a move that is sure to anger Beijing. That's the headline. Instead of saying America bolsters a free nation or America supports the rule of international law by sending the Seventh Fleet. But it's always China's going to be angry. You know, China will take offense. And whoever writes their headlines certainly has a curious way of thinking. And it's consistent if you read Reuters a headline. So it's usually better to read the actual text than stick the headlines, but they're not too bad. But say they still have a presence. You know, there's few enough of those old sort of wire server, old media outfits operating, but Reuters is still around. I just don't know how they've managed to pull it off financially.
Talk to me about Australia. Is there any new facet to the Chinese dance with the Australians, or is it simply more of the same?
Well, one of these is recently it appears that China, or the PRC or CCP has ordered steel makers to not buy Australian coal. So it looks like a boycott of Australian coal exports to China has either begun or is in the offing, and that's a serious thing because Australia exports huge amounts of coal, and this is the latest in sort of economic pressure the Chinese have put on the Australians to try to bring them to heel. And in Australia, the big mineral companies or natural resource companies have a lot of influence, and some of their top guys are very outspoken and pretty much say anything. Yeah, they're outspoken in terms of thinking or saying that Australia really needs to do everything it can to humor China, to accommodate China so they can keep selling their stuff to China. So this is almost a test, I think. It's very interesting to see if Australia will stay the course and keep up their sort of principled and stricter stance towards China than just than most other countries have shown. So it's that coal boycott is the one that really gets your attention. You know, the Chinese cut off or restricted barley imports and wine imports, but when you go after the coal industry, that's a different thing. So this is one to watch.
Got it. All right. What's the next thing you're writing?
Oh boy, I just wrote something just recently that hasn't gone out yet. That is not going to make any friends in either Washington or Tokyo, but I can't help it. You know, I've tried to be an accomplished yes man, but that's coming out, suggesting how we can make things better with the Japanese.
Saw a piece, and comment on this. I saw a piece that said, you know, Japan may be preparing, you know, to cede the Senkaku Islands to China and not push back on that. Did you see that?
That one's actually probably going to be less controversial than the the one that's out shortly. I was just pointing out that Japan, we think that the Japanese will fight to defend their territory, but always consider whether that's actually true. Or whether we can rely entirely on that. That's what I was pointing out in that one. So I'm pointing out something equally controversial in the latest one. But after that, I think I've got a couple more, another Korea piece in the works. I'm just trying to think of an angle. But I'd like to get down to sort of do stuff, write something about Southeast Asia and ASEAN down in the warmer parts of the region.
There's a piece today, I don't know where I saw it, that says, I think I saw it in USNI News, that says that somebody said, hold on, let me find it real quick. Somebody said that the U.S., India, Japan, let's see, FON operations are stretching the U.S. Navy, just so you know, Grant. State Department official, U.S. ties with Japan, India, and Australia should be a model for the region. How about that?
Well, I think that's, I think they should be. And, you know, I think those four nations should go about their business and do what they, you know, think best. And they've really made some good progress, for which somebody in U.S. government, but each nation's government, deserves a lot of credit. Some people do. And go about your business and then create something attractive that other people want to join in. And if it sort of expand naturally, but, you know, stick together and show that you're going to defend your interests and really the interests of freedom, consensual government, etc. And that nothing bad can happen if you do that. If you don't do that, only bad things will happen. So that would that's been some good progress that deserves, I think, some recognition. The so-called Quad that's done more than a lot of people thought it would.
Here's an email for you. Mac, I always love when Grant comes on. I'm curious, relative to the Trans-Pacific Partnership and President Trump's, you've been critical on your show more than once of the president not following that up with something else. In your discussion now turning to China, I'm curious about what Grant thinks. Is there an economic deal that's out there waiting to be struck? Or are there bilateral agreements that are waiting to be struck? And would this further, and then in parentheses he writes, I'll link it to the Marine Corps strategy, not having to roll around on ships, but be in permanent positions or into movable positions on the Philippines and in Vietnam. Might these facilitate greater survivability and greater deterrence using the Marine Corps in the region? That's kind of interesting.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, I think it's really gets to the heart of what America needs to be doing. Is it's not just a military sort of effort, but it needs to be, I think, equal part economic. With the military, you're demonstrating that you'll fight possibly, but people also like to know that that their economy is going to be good, and that when you have a nice economy going, you often feel more like doing more defense-wise, and even maybe being more helpful to the Americans. That if you see your economic future is tied to or dependent on or benefiting considerably from, say, trade and ties with the Americans, well, it bleeds over into the military end of things. And that's where, it'd be nice to see an administration actually implement a good economic strategy that gives special benefits to our friends. And that has been, I think, one of the shortcomings of this administration, that it's intended to pick fights over trade with people who we need their help instead of, say, offering some sweetener, saying, look, yeah, we're going to take on China and we need to do this and this and this, and we've got a deal for you. But in some cases, we've actually put the same sort of trade measures, trade pressure on our friends as we have on China. Sort of a one-size-fits-all, and that's has been a very curious way to do things, and I don't think it's been productive. But if U.S. has really, for some reason, we've never quite gotten the economic end of it right as a parallel part of the military effort. Because you think about it, and all you hear about really is the 7th Fleet, the Marines, the Air Force, etc., out in the region, but you don't get so much attention to sort of a concerted, systematic economic strategy by the United States. And that but you do have to find some government types in particular, combined with a few business types who do understand how you do this sort of thing, how you use trade and economic tools as weapons. Effectively, and then let them run wild. But
Grant, does it seem that the United States lacks a coherent olive government approach to how we deal with China?
Oh, this administration's done better than one would think. They've
I would agree with you. Administration, but in terms of, it doesn't seem like we have the economic piece, because to me, if the president doesn't like TPP, then because we're of our strategy in the Pacific, which is to try to keep the Chinese hemmed inside the first island chain, right? It's imperative that we have, great economic deals with Vietnam, great economic deals, disproportionately tilted in their direction, with the Philippines, with Taiwan, with Japan, with South Korea, right? That while we could have more level agreements with other people, for them, based on our strategic desires, it's really important. For instance, I think that the American Marine Corps floating around on ships is a loser. I don't know what war games say, but I wouldn't be shocked if the majority of those ships weren't sunk immediately. I would be absolutely shocked because they're just such lucrative targets. Okay. When you take those same military formations and you put them on the ground inside Vietnam, you put them on the ground inside the Philippines, they become incredibly more survivable. Well, the enabler of all that is your economic relationship, which begets a military relationship, but it all fuels off the economic value of the partnership. And so to me, it's like, you know, I read about the Fifth Fleet, well, not the Fifth Fleet, I read about the Seventh Fleet, you know, I read about all, you know, Iron Fist and all the, I mean, that's all DOD stuff. Where is the, you know, now we have State Department, where's the economic piece and the all of government approach to our relationship with China? It seems to me that we have never had that kind of an approach.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's true. The one good example of this, of the how the problem manifests itself, is that go to Taiwan. You know, Taiwan's economy, the health or lack of health of it is key. It's essential to Taiwan's ability to survive. And there's been talk for years of creating a bilateral free trade agreement with Taiwan, so that they get special benefits and we do too, but it really benefits the smaller country more.
Right.
And this is something that would have provided a psychological boost to all of Taiwan. It would have made living conditions better and kept young people on the island, kept them, you know, happy, you know, wanting to stay and committed to the place. Would have given the government in Taiwan more confidence that it had more money to spend on defense. And yet, nothing happened. And the excuse was always, well, the Taiwanese won't allow American beef and pork imports, so therefore we won't give them an FTA. But think of the strategic importance of this. And, you know, that I think is hard to deny that
But don't you think that's just a convenient pretext to say no to the Taiwanese?
Yes. But here's, I was almost done, but here was the point. The thing that I think really told you everything was you'd ask about this, and what you would hear as the excuse was, well, USTR, the U.S. Trade Representative, hasn't got the bandwidth, which means, well, they're busy. I mean, you know, well, what is more important than Taiwan? But they're busy. The idea being that, well, they can only do so much work. We can't expect them to, like, work, like, 4 hours a day instead of three. You see this reflected in a lot of places in government. Well, we're just too busy. We don't have the time for a new initiative. Oh, that's just, it's the good idea fairy. Well, how about some sense of what is strategically important and then being willing to work as long as it takes to get the job done? But here, oh, it's we're too busy. And here we've dithered for 20 years. And in a point where now the Chinese have the overwhelming military advantage across the Taiwan Strait. But that's the just sort of sloth, laziness, lack of imagination, not enough votes in it, or whatever it is you need to do, that has kept us, you know, from, as you said, not having a whole-of-government approach or getting the economic part right. Just my sense of it.
Got it. One more question, and I will let you go. In a discussion with three of my friends last Thursday, when the subject of Taiwan somehow or other came up, there was a mention of America's quote unquote strategic ambiguity relative to Taiwan. What the hell does that mean?
Oh, the American position on Taiwan as to whether or not we would fight in their defense has always been as this, at the time, I think, an assistant secretary of defense named Joseph Nye, Ivy League professor, he said, when asked that by the Chinese, I think it was, he said, it depends. And that's a really clever response if you're an American. But when the Chinese hear it, they think, probably not.
Right.
And but that's been that it depends. That so-called strategic ambiguity is the sophisticated word for it, has been, you know, our position on whether or not we will fight to defend Taiwan. And the talk lately has been to end that and say, yes, we will defend Taiwan. That hasn't happened, but that's what's being discussed. So, you know, my take would be that if you say that you're really going to defend Taiwan, you'd better be able to do it. But with a debate, a lot of it seems to be over just whether we change our formal policy, change the wording of it, as if that's going to put off a determined adversary. I think there's two parts of it. If you are going to change it, you're going to say, yes, and here's how we're going to do it, and here's what we're going to develop and create and build up so that anyone who does take us on is going to lose. But that second part of the debate, you don't seem to hear much about. But it's almost an academic argument in some ways that, you know, the foreign policy class is now, you know, churning out millions of words a week over on that issue. But it does come down to, if you make a promise, can you fulfill it? And the bully in the schoolyard, he's usually pretty good at sensing or sizing up your capabilities to hurt him. And if you say you're going to do something, you'd better be able to do it.
Grant, wasn't it that ambiguity that led to the Korean War?
That's how it looks to me. I don't know what you. There are people who could argue that it wasn't really like that. It was different. What Acheson said was, what the Secretary of State said was, not quite that. It didn't. But that's certainly how it's understood by a lot of people, and I think I'm probably still in that class too. Once you know when you said one thing too many, and I think that the Secretary of State did when he was talking about what America would or wouldn't do in Korea. Now, if you have to explain what you really meant, you probably said it the wrong way. But I think that is what gave the communists the belief that we wouldn't do anything.
And I'm sure you could probably find other historical examples on the European continent where the lack of definitively saying we were in or out, or would we be there or not? Well, under these conditions, with these pretexts, blah, 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 gave encouragement to somebody who was looking to do something aggressive militarily. And so interesting, interesting, interesting. All right. I know it's late. The last thing you published is what, and where will we find it?
It's in Asia Times, and I think it's coming out or come out any minute. Asia Times and what is it? I think Japan, about Japan. If you Newsham, Japan, Asia Times, Kishi, the defense minister, visits Washington, something like that. Kishi's the name of the new defense minister. I think it should be out, so you find it there.
I'm looking. I'm not seeing it. Why Japan may cede the Senkakus to China?
No, not that one. There's a newer one. I'll look around for it and send it along.
Asia Time. I'm not seeing it. Let me just re-index, sort by relevance, sort by date. No, I'm not seeing it.
Okay, sort by stridency, and I think it'll come right to the top.
Well, I mean, the piece that you wrote in August, why would Japan cede the Senkakus? After all of what they've done, they would simply turn over the Senkakus to China? I mean, is this the simple realization that we can't resist this thing?
That would be what it is. You know, it's not worth a war, not worth thermonuclear war over some rocks. And that's, you can find Americans who will, you know, we do the same thing. In some ways, it's human nature on display.
All right, sir. First of all, always appreciate the enlightened discourse relative to whether we're talking about journalism. I'll tell you what, if you ask me what I'm concerned about most, that is to me, right? Discourse in the United States is what I'm is what I find most problematic. It is getting worse and worse and harder and harder. And you have institutions like the New York Times who are being run like high school newspapers that somehow or other, you know, the village idiot got their hands on. And except you're talking about the New York Times. And so to me, when you have that going on in the major media companies of a nation, then everything that comes out of that is skewed and wrong and slanted. And so, so you can't, where do you find the truth? Where do you find reporting? Where do you find articulate discourse, you know, from a variety of viewpoints so you can make up your own mind? And in exchange, what you get is woke people that are selling their wokeness and pushing it, and in many cases, pushing it down their throats. And so I don't know. So I appreciate your commentary on the spectrum of issues today. So thank you very much, and have a great week or so.
Okay. Yeah, it's always tiring to sort of bloviate for that, but that's okay. I get it off my chest, and the resentment will build up for another week or two.
All right. Thanks, Grant.
Sure. Pleasure.
There you have it. Grant Newsham here, making us smart about things on the Pacific Rim and his take on journalism. Sad. All right, if you're just tuning in hour one, I was doing some reading yesterday, and honestly, what I read was, in my opinion, stunning, so I drug it into the first hour. It's two pieces that I talk about, and they concern the New York Times. But I consider the New York Times emblematic of... remember that scene in Planet of the Apes when there was like the shot of... was it the Statue of Liberty? Remember that? See if I can find it. Planet of the Apes. Statue of Liberty. Yes, here it is. Here's a picture of it's a picture of the Statue of Liberty, like on a beach with just Lady Liberty sticking up from, she's sticking out from like the chest up. I mean, to me, that should be the building that houses the New York Times. What you have is the carcass of a once great organization. And it's being poorly served by those who run it today. But anyway, how far that organization has fallen. So there's an op-ed guy by the name of Brett Stevens wrote a piece critical of the 1619 project, which has been absolutely taken to task by, again, I would tell you what I'd focus on is the criticism of the historians for it, right? So he took to his op-ed column, and after complimenting the 1619 project for some stuff, he hammered it for others, which was reassuring. The New York Times Guild, which is the union of New York Times employees, so writers et al., right? They then took to their Twitter account to tweet this. It says a lot about an organization when it breaks its own rules and goes after one of its own. The act, like the article, reeks. Now, the tweet is stupid. It's filled with misspellings. And so it was ultimately taken down and said, and what was put in its place was, it was put up in error. All right, so the tweet was deleted. Anyway, so he talks about that, okay? In the midst of that, he mentions the resignation letter of Barry Weiss. And so I then go to that. In that, now she's not, because she's a liberal. okay? She's a liberal. And when she uses the words McCarthyism to describe the New York Times, and I'll read you what she writes in a paragraph, or perhaps it is because they know nowadays that standing up for principle at the paper does not win plaudits. It puts a target on your back. Too wise to post on Slack, which is, I guess, a forum for New York Times employees. They write to me privately about the new McCarthyism that has taken root in the paper of record. Now, for those of you unfamiliar with McCarthyism, it's not a good chapter in American history. Right. So, anyway, I would tell you, relative to democracy, the thing I'm most concerned about is that intellectual discourse appears to be, and the places for that appear to be shrinking, in favor of an intellectual activism that believes it knows the truth and is going to shove it down your throat. I believe that's a form of totalitarianism, and that never works. So that's, you'll get a dose of that in hour one. So anyway, Chris Woodbridge is going to join us tomorrow. Have a great day. On a Tuesday, All Marine Radio. Out. Oh, yeah. Go change somebody's life. That will never be an implied task. It will always be a stated task. So, now I'm out. See ya.